Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Israeli reactions to the P5+1 deal with Iran and speak first with a liberal analyst and then a conservative former advisor to Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Jerusalem-based historian and journalist Gershom Gorenberg joins us to provide a critique of the Prime Minister's condemnation of the agreement, which Netanyahu calls an historic mistake. And we will also discuss Gershom Gorenberg's article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement Anxiety Disorder. Then we will speak with Dr. Joseph Olmert, the former director of the Government Press Office and advisor to former Prime Minister Shamir. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Iranian Agreement, A Possible Realignment of Middle East Politics. And we will discuss Israelis' concerns that the more moderate face of the new leader, Rouhani, disguises the hardline reality of the Supreme Leader's anti-Israeli views that echo the extreme positions of the former Iranian President Ahmadinejad. Then finally, we'll examine a new report in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that finds U.S. emissions of the potent global warming gas methane are 50% higher than EPA government estimates. The co-author of the study, Anna Michalak, a professor at Stanford University School of Earth Sciences, joins us to discuss the increased amount of methane that is 21 times worse than CO2 coming from agriculture and oil and gas production that does not include recent data from fracking and other new drilling. And joining us now from Israel is Gershom Gorenberg, a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and his books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his latest book is The Unmaking of Israel. He has an article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement Anxiety Disorder. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gershom Gorenberg.
Glad to be here.
And your article starts out with the paradox of kind of institutional paranoia that the state of Israel encourages, in a sense, by having everybody have a gas mask ready, not as if there haven't been any incidents in the past and threats, but apparently the defense ministry now is recommending that civilians don't really need them because the Russians and the Americans, with their agreement with Syria, have succeeded in removing Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. So the prospect of Syrian missiles raining down on Israel have gone away. But you point out...
I would moderate that a little bit. Right. First of all, the reason for having the gas masks, I think, was based on originally on a realistic assessment. There was a danger, and it was a practical and low emotion response to a real problem. It was, you know, like having a fire department or something like that. But the major threat of chemical weapons was from Syria. The threat hasn't disappeared, but the evaluation is that it is being successfully and steadily reduced. And under those circumstances, this stopped being a priority for the defense establishment. In that sense, the threat of an attack at the end of the summer from the United States succeeded in pushing Syria and its patron Russia into an agreement to destroy the Syrian chemical weapons without ever having to fight. And besides all the other advantages of that situation, it has also improved security for Israel and for the normal Israeli going about his or her daily business.
Well, I guess, though, the point of bringing this up, and as you do in your article, is that when Obama decided not to attack Iran, and there was a lot of pressure and a lot of expectation that following the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, there was an expectation, because they had crossed the red line that Obama had drawn, that there would be a military strike. And when Obama decided against it and took the diplomatic track, there's no question that Prime Minister Netanyahu could barely conceal his contempt for it. Well, we know he doesn't like Obama to begin with, but there was
no lost love there.
Yes, but it was pretty clear that he felt
that Obama was displaying American weakness. In fact, he made it pretty clear in a speech at the time. So that's, I guess, the real point here. You've got somebody that doesn't seem to understand the value of diplomacy and seems to be completely wedded to military options and is swaggering about ready to go to war. And I would have thought that the Israelis would be kind of war-weary. So why is this man your leader?
Well, first of all, as I wrote in the article, I think that Netanyahu's fear, panicked reaction to agreements is based on a deep sense on his part that agreements fail, that agreements are deception, that they only strengthen your enemy, that the big powers sell you out. This is, as I see it, based on the traumatic experiences of Jews and of Israelis. Not everybody responds to Trump in the same way, but he's not the only one who responds that way. And so very often a leader's feelings, whether they be hopes or fears, resonate with a part of the population, and that gains the person votes. Second of all, Netanyahu is in power at the moment, in large part not because of his own popularity, but because of the failure of the Israeli opposition to unite and run a better campaign last year during the elections. Netanyahu lost a lot of his strength in parliament in the elections, but there was no united opposition that took advantage of that situation. And he is using his, shall we say, bully pulpit as prime minister to insist on the idea that that any agreement with Iran is insufficient. He doesn't put it that way, of course. He says that an agreement could be sufficient if it led to a total dismantlement of every aspect of Iran's nuclear program. But since an agreement of that sort isn't in the offing, basically what he's saying is that no agreement is sufficient. And he's been very public about that. He was public about not appreciating the advantages of the agreement on Syrian chemical arms, and he's been only more strident about the agreement with Iran.
Well, of course, there is historical justification for Israelis and Jews in general to be skeptical of the great powers, given the history of Munich, the appeasement of Hitler, and, of course, the British shutting the doors on Palestine to Jews in 1939. And there's no question that Israel is very skeptical of the United Nations. But the P5 plus one is the permanent five with Germany. These are the world powers. This agreement wasn't just with the Americans, who clearly Netanyahu doesn't trust. They're effectively with the world. Kerry's gone out of his way to say we're not stupid. In fact, he got frustrated on Israeli television and basically was talking about the Palestinian issue and said something to the effect that, do you want a third intifada? And isn't that at the heart of what's going on here, that Netanyahu is so wedded to the narrative over Iran because it serves to distract from the Palestinian issue that isn't going away, but somehow the Israeli right, well, you tell me, what is the Israeli right's plan here? What is their end game? As much as they clearly don't want to seriously negotiate with the Palestinians, what's the alternative?
Well, first of all, I would say regarding Netanyahu, I can't enter his mind and figure out whether this is a deliberate ploy, a cynical ploy to take attention off of the Palestinian issue, or whether he deeply believes that the only or the central problem that should be addressed is Iran, or possibly politically a combination of both of those things. But he has certainly tried to focus as much attention on the Iran issue as possible, and that has distracted from dealing with the Palestinian issue. The question of the right's end plan is really, it's a big question. I mean, I've been talking, interviewing people on the Israeli right for 30 years. There's many possibilities suggested. None of them are realistic. And In the end, the ultimate answer is the status quo is better for us than any of the alternatives that have been offered. So we're just going to have to hang on and, until everybody else is exhausted and puts up with the situation. I personally think that that's an incredibly unrealistic approach, but there really isn't an end plan. The end plan is this is the best we can do, so we're just going to keep doing it.
So, Gershom Gorenberg, excuse me. Again, I'm speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who is in Israel. He's a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist who is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and his books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his latest book is The Unmaking of Israel. He has an article at the American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement, Anxiety Disorder. So what's happening now, Gershom, here is that the Congress seems to be gearing up to try and scuttle this deal, or at least those supporters of the Israeli right in terms of APAC, the Israeli lobby, which seems to have basically it started out with a lot of traction amongst Democrats, and it probably still has. In fact, there are a lot of Democrats lining up now to oppose this deal, but most of the more strident and frankly idiotic remarks are coming from Republican senators and from the Republican spin machine through Fox News, or the Republican Pravda through Fox News, where they're basically talking about Obama's somehow got the mullahs to make this deal to distract Americans from the botched launch of Obamacare.
Conspiracy theories know no end.
But the question is, I mean, what is this display of fealty on the part of the American Congress, the senators and the House, on both parties to right-wing Israeli politics? Whatever happened to J Street? I mean, we have this paradox here where something like 75% of American Jews who support Israel are on the liberal side and support the peace plan and support, the Obama administration, but somehow that's not reflected in the Congress.
Well, I would say several things here very quickly. One is I would advise all of those elected representatives to pay more attention to what Israeli analysts, professional analysts, ex-generals, and so forth have been saying about this agreement, which is either much more softly critical to cautiously supportive and completely on a different tone than Netanyahu has been speaking. For instance, the nuclear expert, Professor Uzi Evan, today pointed out that the biggest risk from Iran was from production of plutonium. That's the only kind of nuclear weapon that can be mounted on a missile, and therefore stalling the Iranian reactor that would have produced plutonium is a huge success for this diplomatic path. The second thing is the mood coming out from Washington, at least as I can read it, is already shifting in the sense that instead of there being support for immediate sanctions, there's talk of more talk in actual legislative terms of sanctions if this six-month agreement doesn't work out, which shows a retreat. And the third thing is, I really think that it's fascinating in this context, is that in a situation where there was a clear American strategic interest facing off with APAC and other lobbying groups, their power it seems to have been much less than is commonly assumed. That is to say, it is much easier for elected officials to go along with what the lobby wants when there's no good, clear policy option. And so deciding between bad options, okay, you have this pressure from a lobby in one direction. In this case, the president saw a clear opening for a strategic improvement of the American situation. And while nobody can make a prediction of what's going to happen in Congress, I suspect that this whole situation is going to reveal the limits of AIPAC's power. And I think it's very important to pay attention to that, because there is a tendency to only notice their successes. And the irony of that situation is they advertise their successes in order to get support. Constantly attributing to the lobby more power than it actually has, it is actually very helpful to it. And this situation may well produce a proof of the limits of that lobby's power.
Well, when you talk, though, about, and you mentioned security figures in Israel, military and defense analysts, saying that the agreement is in Israel's interest, you're referring to the Arak heavy water reactor, which is the same kind of reactor that the Israelis have at Dimona. But the difference between Israel and Iran in the nuclear portfolio is profound and extraordinary. Israel has about 200 deliverable nuclear weapons. Iran has none. And Iran, while the Arak reactor is not complete, there is no capability on the part of the Iranians to reprocess the plutonium that would come out of these spent fuel rods, whereas Israel...
Well, one of the aspects of the agreement is to freeze development of that potential. That's part of the whole
right.
list of things that freezes the plutonium path on the Iranian on the part of the Iranians. It doesn't
right.
end it, but it freezes it for the 6-month interim agreement and opens the opportunity to roll it back in a final agreement or in a permanent agreement.
Right, but the reactor is definitely being built, but there's no evidence, as far as I know, that they have reprocessing for plutonium fuel rods.
No, the issue is developing that potential, and as I said, the one point in the agreement is freezing that development. So that stopping development at this point of the Arak reactor is essentially putting the plutonium program at a dead stop for the period of the agreement. And since that's the most potentially dangerous part of the Iranian program, that's quite an achievement for diplomacy.
So just in closing then, Gershom Gorenberg, as much as the world is hailing this agreement as an historic agreement, and of course Netanyahu is saying it's a historic mistake, but nevertheless there is a sense that the new President Rouhani is a breath of fresh air. The Supreme Leader still is saying incredibly hostile and poisonous anti-Israel statements, which we're all familiar with. And so from an Israeli point of view, and we're going to be talking to a right-wing Israeli coming up who's to be the press spokesperson for Yitzhak Shamir, but from your point of view as a liberal, I guess, or a dove, I don't know how you want to be labeled, Gershom, but what is, in terms of what threatens your country, is the rhetoric from the familiar, you know, death, well, they're not going to be saying death to America anymore, apparently, or at least they're going to tone that down, but they still continue to say death to Israel and wipe Israel off the map. On the other hand, you have the Saudis, who appear to be in a kind of tacit alliance with Israel on many respects. They both support the military government in Egypt, for example. The Saudis are unleashing these incredibly toxic jihadis in Syria, and they've unleashed the Taliban and al-Qaeda and you name it around the world. So there's a potential in this agreement to shift away from Saudi Arabia, if you will, in this proxy war going on in the Middle East, towards Iran. And a lot of analysts think in the long run we're better off dealing with Iran than Saudi Arabia, because this regime will continue to export its radical elements, and all it cares about is staying in power.
Look, this is, even for somebody who is a dove and is on the left side of Israeli politics being realistic, this is not a nice neighborhood, and it's not a good idea to romanticize the qualities of any of the players. If there is a possibility of shifting Iran through diplomacy to be less dangerous, that's a net gain for Israeli security. If you look at what's going on in the debate in Israel at this moment, you will also see a very large amount of criticism of the government, and particularly of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, for causing a crisis in relations with the United States and Europe, given that those alliances are a strategic asset, perhaps the most important strategic asset that Israel has. So when you're looking at Netanyahu's international statement, there's a tendency in the international press to pay most attention to the leader of a country, and even in a democracy, to act as if that leader speaks for the entire people. Well, George W. Bush didn't speak for you. And Netanyahu doesn't speak for everybody in Israel. And in fact, he's taking considerable criticism, which you probably won't find from hear from your next interviewee, for endangering the relationship with Israel's allies.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Israel, Gershom Gorenberg.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who's a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect, and he blogs at southjerusalem.com. His books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967-77, and The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. His latest book is The Unmaking of Israel, and he has an article at The American Prospect, Bibi's Agreement, Anxiety, Disorder. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Dr. Joseph Olmert, the former government press advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir.